As above, so below.
Welcome to Connecting with Coincidence. I am your host, Bernard Beitman, MD. I'm a psychiatrist. I study meaningful coincidences. I've written a book called Meaningful Coincidences. The cover is over my right shoulder. And I invite you to come to the Coincidence Cafe. It meets every third Saturday of the month on Zoom at 11 a.m. Eastern time in the United States. And we talk about coincidence stories. We tell each other coincidence stories. And that's the idea. If you have stories to tell and you want to hear other people's stories, please go to our website, The Coincidence Project, and you can sign up just once and you'll be notified every month about the next meeting. And please do subscribe to this channel. It really helps get the messages out about meaningful coincidences. There's a lot of interest out there in them. It seems to be expanding, at least as far as I can tell from this position that I am in. Well, my coincidence story is with me and nature. It happened not too long ago. Those of you who have hung around with me on this podcast know that I have communications with trees. And there's three of them. I call them the threes in a forest near Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live. So I was lining up with them as I usually do. There's three trees and I become the fourth point and make a rhombus out of ourselves. So I kind of like walk into it and it's kind of like hooked in. We get connected and I get in that position. I dance with them and communicate with them. As we are increasing the intensity of our connection right then, it's raining, not very hard. I like being out in the woods and when it's raining, I, for some reason, raise both my arms. And at the moment I raised both my arms, the rain intensity increased. I said, well, wait a minute. What? So how'd that happen? Coincidence. Okay, maybe. So why did it come down heavily at that time? I kind of wondered. After a little while, I asked the trees, what can be done about my son Carlin's mysterious intestinal ailments? He's been to a lot of doctors. They don't know what to do about him. And at that moment, when I ask, there's a burst of thunder, a very loud one. And it hadn't been thundering until then. And I thought, oh, wait, what's that? And then shortly after that, I looked down at the face of a sawed-off log lying perpendicular to the trees, and a worm was hovering over the face of that log, frantically swinging its end around, seeking some stability, some way forward. Well, these happen in a short period of time, two coincidences with the rain and then the thunder, and then looking down and seeing a worm. And I've been there lots of times. I haven't seen a worm running around. It was raining, so there were more worms running around, but I still hadn't seen that before. So what personal meaning can I find in this series of low probability events? I don't know. So I asked a friend of mine who's has more experience like this, a board member of the Coincidence Project, and she said, maybe he's got parasites. That's what I get. So my son is getting, I mentioned that to him. He had not been tested for parasites for his intestines. And we'll see if that actually comes out to mean anything for him. Our guest today is Carl Johan Kallman, who was born in Stockholm, Sweden, where he is right now. He hadn't been there for 6 years. He has a PhD from the University of Stockholm in physical biology from 1984 and has been a senior researcher at the Department of Environmental Health at the University of Washington in Seattle, where I was a faculty member for 10 years. He has served as an expert on cancer for WHO and co-authored have been quoted more than 1,500 times in scientific literature. He is recognized as the main proponent of the idea that the Mayan calendar reflects the evolution of consciousness. And he's developed a complete theory around this. He's also written a fantastic book. And the title of it, I'll have to read it, The Living Universe, The New Theory of Origins. I mean, this is like how this whole thing got started, how we got here, which includes explaining consciousness, the Big Bang, fine-tuning dark matter, the evolution of life, and human history. There's a lot in here. This guy's got a very, very large mind, and we're not going to be able to talk about everything in this book, of course. We'll talk about a couple of things that are very interesting to me that we share as an interest for both of us. But first, Carl, please tell us a coincidence story.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I can't avoid saying the fact that we both have been working at the University of Washington is a good coincidence, but because I think neither of us knew that from the beginning when you set this up. So there is a coincidence there. And yes, I will tell you a more maybe more dramatic, for me personally anyway, coincidence story, which is that in 1984, I did something in Stockholm that was called the EST training. Maybe you've done it yourself, which would add another coincidence, but maybe not. I mean,
I do know about Earhart seminar training, and that was a big thing for a long time. It's evolved, yes.
Yes. And anyway, at that time, I was still, you know, I was fairly rooted here in Stockholm. I had a family here. I had my friends. I had a job at the University of Stockholm. But what came up, they had a process where you were supposed to go inside of yourself and identify your home on this planet, where do you belong, or something like that. I can't remember exactly the wording that they had. But so anyway, we sat down and closed our eyes and sort of went into some kind of a meditative state. And what came up for me was some kind of a eight-sided house in some kind of mossy forest in what looked like Northern California to me. And as part of, you know, as a result of this training, I was sort of kicked out of, like coming out of a cannon, changing my life in ways that, you know, were not simply planned. I just went along with whatever happened, and soon I left my job there at the University of Stockholm, and no, about a year after this training, I sent out applications to maybe 50 universities in the United States, and so the first response, actually positive response, actually came from a place in Seattle that was called the Pacific Northwest Research Foundation, and they wanted to have me as an acting head for a department at that research center. And I didn't immediately say yes to this, even though I thought it was interesting, just because it was sort of in the direction of this vision that I've had. But then I also got offers from MIT and Columbia University to come and do research in these places. I even accepted the to go to Columbia University, but had nightmares and felt that, no, that's not the right thing. I went back to the people in Seattle and said, are you still interested in me coming? And yes, they said yes, and they've organized the visa and stuff like that. And so 2 years after I had this vision, I landed in Seattle, a place I had never visited before, and knew nobody, and came with my skis, being picked up by one of the employees at this research institute. Then So then I was quite lost initially when I came to Seattle, wondering a little bit why I had ended up there. But then after a couple of months, a man came up to my office, and it was some. I took a liking to him. He was committed to identifying pesticides in the house dust that toddlers might ingest, and so he wanted to talk to me as a toxicologist. And I simply liked him because he was the kind of person that he was not this in this, he didn't have this commitment because of his own career or his own financial situation or something like that, but, because he wanted to do good to the planet. And so we met a couple of times, and then at one point he told me that he was a theosophist, and he also told me then that next weekend we're going to have a work party up at Orcas Island in the San Juan Islands, at their camp there called Indralaya, and asked me if I just wanted to come along. And then I said, sure, absolutely. And we went up there and came there after work, and it was in the middle of the night and it was dark, and went to bed in his little cabin there. And then when I woke up in the morning, in the center of this camp was exactly that eight-sided house that I had seen in that original vision at the S training. And it wasn't Northern California, but from a Swedish perspective, Washington State is pretty much not very, very different in location, so to speak. And it wasn't just any house. I mean, it's probably not the only eight-sided house I've seen. The Navajos in New Mexico, they have their Hogans, which are basically eight-sided as well. But this just happened to look exactly as I had envisioned it in that original vision. And it was exactly moss-covered as I had seen. I don't know if this counts as synchronicity or an expression of some kind of higher guidance, but for me, it really meant something. I made that mean that I was guided to go there, and it sort of changed my whole outlook on being in Washington State and in at the University of Washington later, and then in the United States, because it was something I interpreted as meant to happen. And it's just also, it told me something also, more philosophically speaking, namely that maybe we can, if we are focused on something or something drives us, maybe all knowledge is actually accessible to us. I have had no reason to know that the existence of this particular house. And then, afterwards it came to take on additional meanings in different ways. But it was really a change in my outlook on life, and ever since I've had different kinds of synchronicities appear to me at different points in time, but it's always, I should also say, for at least for me, there's always a matter of sort of interpreting it. Not every synchronicity is meaningful in my view anyway, but this one certainly was so.
Your analysis runs parallel with mine. We're finding more of those. That is it a coincidence or is it a synchronicity? Yes, and it's simply a synchronicity because you had one image, an image in your mind, and then you had an external reflection of that. So there was a mirror of them, and that's a standard version of synchronicity. Where your vision came from, sometimes they come from dreams. This time it came from being in an altered state with Est, which will get you in an altered state, and it did. So you were able to tap into something. And given that you've written a book that tries to explain how everything works, I mean, it's and that's quite a claim that you've got with that subtitle. So I would like, you've also said the meaning of it to you personally, that you were guided and it confirmed your being there in what I'll call ecotopia, because Northern California up to Seattle, including Vancouver too, tends to be different from Southern California, and ecotopia has been named for it. So you were still, you don't have to call it Northern California, but there you were, something where you then saw something that made you confirmed in your decision to move to that area of the world, that you felt you were being guided. Now that's that's an important part of all this, because you have such a large mind, and you're thinking about large questions. How do you think this guidance took place?
Well, I'm glad that is still a mystery to me. Maybe God sits there and sort of puts slides into the heads of people, and then they do what they. Well, you know, if you want my honest opinion, something of that order is really what I believe. But even though if I try to concretize it, it will sound a little bit silly, as it did now.
Well, I'm being silly. So I'm being silly because in my evolution, I'm running across an increasing number of references to spirit guides. And knowing, I know a friend of mine, I just interviewed her on this podcast. Her name is Lillian, and Lillian, and Lillian Fortna has spirit guides guiding her, and you can see her live and in person communicating with them, as if they're almost like a bunch of bees floating around her, and she's kind of like talking with them. So she made it look like it's real, and I've been hearing that from more people, and I decided, because of Lillian Fortna, to find someone who is a psychic who could connect me with my guides, which the psychic did, and gave me some pretty good ideas of things to do. So I think there's something else, and saying that it's God is an easy way out, because it's we don't know what we mean by that. We could talk about a synchronized universe, which of course is what you're talking about. But there's something, as a scientist, you and a scientist, as I try to be, is work my way up into getting more data that I can have as a foundation for my next speculation. It's looking like you are being guided, and by what or by whom? Spirit guides is my current answer for that. Have you thought about that one?
Spirit guides. I've certainly, people have told me, so to speak. It doesn't really resonate with me.
Good. I'm glad it doesn't. I'm glad it doesn't, because, and why doesn't it resonate with you?
Because I want God in the picture.
Well, this does not obviate God being in the picture. This doesn't at all. No.
No, it doesn't. I can't tell. No, I really have no good answer to that.
Well, there's two.
But let me, if I may, go into something that happened this weekend, which is related to this.
Please
so,
do.
Yeah. So I was in Oslo, the capital of Norway, and I was there to give a presentation of my book and things at something called the Sami House. And I'm not sure, are you familiar with the Sami people in Scandinavia? It's
no.
basically the only indigenous people in Europe. They've been taking the role of reindeer herding for hundreds of years in northern Scandinavia, in northern Norway and Finland, Sweden, and so forth. And I had been invited by a man who is a shaman of that particular lineage and belongs to that particular people. And so we were sitting there, he was thinking of what shall I do to make some kind of an advertisement for my talk. And what happened then was that a flock of ravens came down to us from up from the mountain and sort of set down in the tree where we were sitting. And I think there were seven of ravens. And this man, he's a little bit older than I am and is a very experienced shaman, he said he'd never seen that many ravens coming. And it was absolutely obvious that they came down to sit in the tree next to where we were sitting, and then they left and came back. And there was some kind of significant message in this. That is more like, I guess, spirit guiding or nature guiding you or so than God guiding you. So in that sense, yeah, that happens too.
That happens too. And the story I told at the beginning was something like that.
Yes.
It was nature and
yes.
You. And I appreciate your telling that story, because there's, you can get to a place where you're open and nature responds. Yesterday, last night I was outside and I was going to talking. I was thinking about connecting with my spirit guides through the psychic again. And I said to the sky, well, I'm going to connect with you pretty soon. It was a lightning flash at that moment. I mean, there was heat lightning going on, but that yeah. hadn't been happening. It was right then again. I said, that was like, okay, for me, that was like saying, okay. So how that happens is part of the fun of this, but that it happens. How did you interpret the ravens in the tree?
Well, it came to be, you know, first of all, that I'm using Eirik's interpretation, and his interpretation was that we were doing something significant. Now, to me, though, it was another, even more personal aspect of this. And this is that on my father's side of the family, they come from the far north of Sweden, the north of the Arctic Circle, so to speak. And we talked about it, and that's where this indigenous people basically has been living, and so he came to conclude, my friend there came to conclude that I must also have a significant amount of heritage from this particular people. And I think that's really what I took away from it, even if he thought that, you know, they were just telling us it's important what you're doing here. I think to me, they signified, yes, importance, but in another way, you know, to see another aspect of my own personal heritage, and that is what I think I will come to remember from this particular event. But it also illustrates how you can, you know, you can interpret these things in any way you like, but something. Well, not really, not maybe any way you like it. Something, it has to, you know, for it to be meaningful, it has to have some kind of heart connection, and you'll have to,
That's what I was thinking. That's all right. It has to have some kind of heart connection. That's just what I was feeling before you said that. That it has to have some heart connection, and I could feel the heart connection as you were telling me, and then you confirmed it. So it's got to resonate with your heart somehow, and then that informs your mind about something. And when I hear this story about the Samis and your heritage above the Arctic Circle, I love that. I love being able to transmute myself for a moment into above the Arctic Circle, because there's a romance about the coldness up there and the survival ability up there that's been amazing to me all my life. And then you go from the Arctic Circle to Central America and become interested in Mayans. And that's a connection that I can have some feeling about, because it's still indigenous. And so your background, Sami background, probably has some influence on your interest in Mayan culture.
Yeah, I think so. It certainly has created some attraction to indigenous peoples. That's what I think. And then the Maya came to have a special role among them. So yes,
it's a global connection, and it's a beautiful way of thinking. But let's go to a question that we are both interested in, which may be still related. You are interested, as I am, in simultaneous independent inventions and discoveries, and you seem to have some idea about how that happens. I wonder if you would describe some examples, and then tell us how you think some of them happen.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the way I look upon it, I am basing myself on the Mayan calendar, and meaning that I've studied the cosmology of the Maya. And, you know, there might have been a reason that I went to the Maya rather than to the Sami, or at least it took me 30 years to come back to the Sami or so. And the reason is that they have calendars. And if you have calendars, you have numbers. And if you have numbers, you have the potential of science. And so from that perspective, I wanted to expand on their calendar system to make it some kind of globally encompassing scientific theory. When it comes to synchronicities, you might say that a very important aspect of the Mayan calendar system is that they describe time periods as plumed serpents, which I then translate into meaning something like quantum waves. In other words, I think that the ancient peoples, which all over the planet were honoring a serpent as a creator god, I mean, it still happens in certain parts of the world, but in ancient times it was very, very widespread. And what that means is that the wave movement means, in this particular case, is that when there is a peak in the wave movement, like a peak, then there is forward movement. That's why they used to say that the plumed serpent is the bringer of civilization and the bringer of life. And then On the other hand, when it goes, the wave movement goes down into a valley, it's the opposite. If any, it may be a backlash, it may be some kind of partial destruction of what has happened in the preceding peak era. And it goes up like and down like this. And this wave movement is a global wave movement. And in principle, as I understand it, it means that people anywhere can download, create resonance with this particular wave movement. And as they do, it means that they will also their way of looking at reality, which is, you know, part of what underlies the making of inventions, that will follow the same wave movement around the planet. And to some extent, we see this on a very broad scale. You know, for instance, one of these waves were activated in as recently as 1999, and that is, in my interpretation, a wave that has created a digital world, a digital revolution that is still going on. And so since the activation of this particular wave or this particular expression of the plumed serpent, if you want to speak that kind of language, since that point in time, the whole world has basically been adapting to the digitalization of technology and so forth. And what this means is then that the activation of such a wave, and you know, it does coincide, the activation of this wave does coincide with the time when internet really became interactive, and when smart technologies started to be introduced in many places. And in a sense, this thing that happened, you know, you might say Silicon Valley was at the heart of it, but at the same time, it spread rapidly. And I don't even know how many synchronistic, how many independent and synchronistic events that it encompasses. But I do, you know, to give a much more concrete example, I would like to take the invention of the telephone. There is another wave that was activated in 1755. And that's not the digital revolution, obviously, but that is what I would call the industrial revolution that starts with a similar kind of wave movement where the peaks in this quantum wave tend to foster novelties in all areas of industry, basically. And so a typical case then to look at as one of many, many different aspects of independent inventions is the invention of the telephone, which took place very close to, in 1876, very close to the activation of one of these peaks. And as a result, you know, the story is fairly well known. Alexander Graham Bell comes into the patent office 3 hours, I think, before his competitor, Eliza Gray, I think it was his name, who in some other parts of the U.S. Made the same kind of invention, essentially. And as it generally happens, I couldn't exactly say his name. The winner takes it all, in a sense. But it is a case of certainly a case of an independent and simultaneous invention. But it's also something then that I can attribute to the shift in the minds, actually, that happens in people as a result of these waves that the ancient peoples would refer to as the plumed serpent.
How is it that you know that the peak of the wave occurred in 1999, in 1876? How do you have an independent track of that?
Well, that is from a couple of steles that the Maya left behind, most notably one in Coba, at the Yucatan Peninsula, but also at Yaxchilan. They listed various waves that had. There was a system where every higher wave had a 20-fold increased frequency with which it develops, and you can back calculate this, and from those back calculations you can get the system that they honored. The most evident way of looking at it, though, is to look at the many nine-storied pyramids that they left behind. All their major Mayan temple sites have, in a central location, a pyramid that's built in nine levels. It's the nine worlds, or the nine states of consciousness, each of which is brought by one of these plumed serpents and bringing civilizations to human beings.
And how do, well, I guess you're implying that how those nine levels correlate in time with the simultaneous inventions.
Yeah.
And I don't, how do you seem to be saying that the stele, usually a stone or concrete kind of thing, has writing on it and it's preserved.
Yes.
And there's correlations between the Mayan calendar descriptions of time passing with the plumed serpent hitting a peak. How does that connect with the nine floors of the pyramids?
Have you been to any Mayan site?
No.
No. Okay. A wonderful way of getting into it is actually to visit Chichen Itza at spring equinox, which is the single day of the year when a pattern of these seven peaks and six dark valleys, you might say, are appearing as a shadow on the staircase or the pyramid. And so, in a sense, I'm making a case where I'm putting together things that probably seem very obvious to the Maya, but it doesn't say, you know, it doesn't specifically say that this is how we see it, so to speak. I have had to put together information from different sources, and in the end, I'm convinced that it makes sense what comes out of it. For instance, through looking at these kind of synchronicities, you could say that You know, to take another kind of example, if you go to another wave, the sixth wave, there's nine waves. The one with the digital world, that's the eighth wave. The one with the industrial world is the seventh wave. The one with the civilizations, the basic civilizations, that's the sixth wave. And that's the one that the Maya would use always when they dated all their pyramids, because they looked upon life in relationship to this. And in order for a king to tell his people of how important he was and that he was really worthy of being a king, he would point to times in that particular calendar where he might have been born or accessed the throne or something like that. And that came to be, to them, that was evidence. It wouldn't be evidence to a modern person. We wouldn't look upon it like that. Most of it wouldn't. But to them, it was. And but if you go with this long count, which is the sixth of the wave waves, then that began in 3115 BC, and then it comes to its peak, its seventh peak in 1617 in our counting. And you know, this leads into what we call the shift in mentality among human beings, what we call the scientific revolution, basically. And not so long after that, in the maybe 1660s or 80s, then you have the synchronicity of Leibniz and Newton creating calculus essentially independently. But it's a remarkable, if you go to the year 1617, then really that's the shift point. That's when the new peak begins in this particular wave. And that's when Galilei and Kepler are, for the first time in human history, are introducing mathematics in the study of physics. And so it's a major thing. And then comes all these, there is sort of a burst of mathematical innovativeness that comes at that point in time, whether it's the logarithm, whether it's the Pascal's counting machine, whether it's Fermat's infinitesimal calculus or Pascal's probability theory. It comes like as if it's riding on a wave, and much, you know, none of this was there were prior to that. There was also mathematics slowly developing then, but then when it really burst through the scientific revolution, that was at this point in time that you can quite precisely find based on the Mayan calendar and its wave movements.
Going to give you a smaller example and see how that fits. In March, around March 12th, 1951, two independent, apparently proven independently as well as you can, cartoonists developed a character named Dennis the Menace. One in England and one in the United States. They both had dogs, and they both caused trouble in different ways. The British one did it on purpose. He was a bad boy. And the American one stumbled into trouble most of the time. The dogs were always helpful to them. So in the same week, what do you make out of that? How does that fit?
I wouldn't make an interpretation of it, but I assume it's, you know, these waves are creating flows, and they're flowing maybe similarly they are flowing similarly in England and in the United States. And but I wouldn't go be able to go in and pinpoint exactly.
It goes to waves, and I've trying to figure out the basic patterns of the way things work, at least here on Earth, and polarity is one, and you just talk about polarity, but the sine wave is so fundamental to the way things work. Light and sound and so many other things follow the sine wave. The sine wave has in it a normal curve, a Gaussian curve. So there's kind of another basic part of the universe, and at least as we live it right here in the middle of us, of one of the peaks of a sine wave or the bottom of a sine wave. And if you take a helix and slice it down the middle, that helix has a sine wave in it also. So what you're describing as the plumed serpent, in simpler terms for me, is a sine wave that you're describing runs through time. And the Mayans have been able to make this more evident to themselves. And I want to be able to ask you, even though, I mean, you're from Sweden, and your name is Swedish, but Kalaman sounds like calendar man.
You're not the first one. You know, my friend Tim Johnson, a film producer in Aspen, he says that. He loves to identify connections between names and what people are doing. And he does it very well. And
I love. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about this name Kalaman, it's my grandfather then, who actually his name was Carlson. Now there were millions of people, hundreds of thousands probably in Sweden, who was called Carlson if you go back 100 years ago, but then he decided to change it. And it has some kind of a meaning in Swedish that it's hard to convey. It's a little bit, sounds like a nickname rather than a real surname, so to speak. And so the good thing about it is that there's maybe 10 people or 5 people who has that name in Sweden. And if anybody hears my name, they won't forget it. They will always remember it. And so it's been useful. And he up there in the Arctic, he had no such idea that it could have ever become a useful thing. He just wanted to not have the same name that everybody else were having.
Oh, that's good. That's good. And he picked one. And I'm very, it's a thing, and your friend talks about it, of how names influence our behavior, as well as how maybe our behavior influences our name. And I'm very interested in too. But let's go to another question that you are indirectly talking about. How are the processes in the universe synchronized?
Well. I look upon it as if there is a sort of a nested hierarchy of holons, holons of consciousness, that ultimately originate in a cosmic holon, a cosmic consciousness. But then over time, that sphere, that cosmic sphere that defines the cosmic consciousness, has trickled down and sort of divided itself up into smaller units of consciousness, like a galaxy, like a star system, like a planet, like a human being, and so forth. So this trickle down mechanism seems to be just the way that the universe is designed. But as a consequence of that, is that there will appear a lot of synchronicities between any of these holons that have been synchronistically created. And one aspect of this then is the entanglement, I would say, the thing that gave a couple of people Nobel Prizes in December of last year, the finding that particles that are created simultaneously and at some point, quite irrespectively of how distant they may move from each other in the universe, will still be entangled, so that when the quantum state of one of them changes, then instantaneously the other state, the state of the other particle will change. Now, in established science, that would be mostly interpreted as if it's the particles, like the more or less the matter of these two different particles that are connected, but. You know, that's a choice, I would say, that's consistent with a kind of materialist worldview. And I think it's equally valid to simply say that, well, these are actually two small holons on the level of an electron, that the holons and the consciousness of these is actually what is being entangled and connecting these particular particles, irrespectively of the distance that they may be at. But then, you know, if this is true, then it would mean that all of these holons of consciousness, regardless of where in the nested hierarchy that they are located, would be entangled, or potentially be entangled. And it's then the consciousness of these holons that are entangled. And from this, you know, comes a kind of worldview that not only makes it reasonable to understand that there is a lot of synchronistic processes in the creation of the universe, but it's, you know, it also gives another opening to understanding the concept of God. You know, when you say God, it's not the best word, because it people have associations that may go to religions that are 2,000 or 3,000 years old or something like that, but what I look upon here is simply the cosmic consciousness. I would say that is what people over time have been calling God, that they have given that cosmic consciousness the name of God. And then if you take this to another step and you say that, well, that would mean that every electron in the universe would be entangled with this cosmic center, including any holon, any human holon, including any human state of consciousness, would also be part of this entanglement with the cosmic consciousness. And if we are entangled in this way, as I'm outlining here and arguing with some evidence, then we could understand that, you know, there are many, many processes in the universe that are synchronized. We may probably never get a full picture of it, but we can get some evidence from it, and that's why I've been focusing so much on the Mayan sine waves, as we agreed to call it.
Would you please define holon?
Holon? No, I can't do that. I not really. It's some kind of non-physical boundary between creating some dichotomy between the inner and the outer. But, you know, I'm of the opinion of both Max Planck and Erwin Schrödinger that that consciousness is fundamental. It can never be referred to, it can never be explained by reference to something else. It is one of those things that we just have to start with. That's my view. So I can't define it really. I mean, I can describe certain aspects of it, but define, no.
Well, you are implying a definition of boundary with the word holon. That it's somehow, it's something is contained, consciousness is contained within some kind of boundary, like the electron has a boundary around it. And it's not a physical boundary. Some kind of aspect of consciousness that creates a boundary. And that's the way I was hearing what you're talking about, and the layeredness of the universe, the Russian dolls in one inside of another. That metaphor is very clear in the way you were describing it, describing consciousness and going from the large down to increasingly small, so that this consciousness of my brain, my mind, your mind have a boundary around them that's very permeable, that is like a part of the whole thing, but it contains its opposite, as so many different things do. The boundary, the boundary is both a boundary and something open to the outside, and it keeps shifting depending on the circumstances. And it's almost like a wave and a particle. You name it, and it's got a boundary. You make it a wave. You can leave it alone. It's kind of blending with everything else. That's that kind of polarity that coincidences make people think about, to be able to think about the polar opposites as part of the same thing. They're both polarity and connected to each other. There's a continuum and polarity. And this is very hard for human beings to understand and conceptualize. We're either one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are what you seem to be implying when you describe holon.
Yeah. I agree. Well said.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Now I think I have a better idea about what you mean by God. And other people now are saying quite commonly, the universe did this for me. And I think they may be referring to something similar to what you're talking about.
They probably do. But I would say that there is matter also in the universe. And I don't think the matter in the strict sense of the word will influence us on a distance or something like that. The matter in the strict sense of the world will not create synchronicities for us.
Ah. So matter doesn't matter when it comes to synchronicity is another wordplay.
No, they're just being used, I would say. Matter is probably being used by consciousness to create synchronicities.
Yeah, well, this matters to me right here, this thing I can bang in my head with. Well, we're coming near the end, and one of the fascinating things about what you're writing about is dark matter. Dark matter, dark energy, we keep hearing 95% of the universe are made up of those two things. Maybe 5% or 6% is made up of what we think of as physical matter. Please solve for us in the next 5 minutes what dark matter and dark energy are.
Well, basically, I think they are non-existent, both of them. So that's a very easy answer. You know, they have to be treated differently, dark matter and dark energy. When it comes to dark matter, I think the main evidence for its existence is the fact that the stars of galaxies do not behave in the same way as the planets of solar systems. And so since it doesn't seem that the laws of Kepler applies also to the galactic level, they've seen that there is something missing here. There's something they really can't explain, and the assumption is that there must be a particular constant, a specific constant of gravitation in the sense that Newton defined it. And I don't think that is true. I simply think that on that level there might be other constants applicable, and maybe it's quantized. Maybe there are certain numbers that these constants of gravitations may have, or maybe it's a fluid number, so to speak. But that's what I've been looked at, and this is part. This is part of the argument that I'm making in the book that the galaxies are alive. You know, if you have a dead phenomenon, it could follow the laws of nature or the law of gravitation, for instance. Now, if you, on the other hand, if you have a living dog and you see it running around there, there's no way that you can find a mathematical formula that describes its movement. In other words, there's no way you could just describe a living thing with a specific constant of gravitation fitting into a law of gravitation. And so I think this is really, and I know it's maybe hard to follow what I'm saying here, but I think this is one of the significant arguments that the galaxies are huge living structures. They're not living in the same sense as we are living, but nonetheless, they have many properties in common with living species. And one of the aspects of this is that if you simply ignore that reasoning of dark matter, you will find another argument that the universe is alive. And I think that is a very important aspect of what I'm trying to convey in this book, that the universe is alive and we're part of it, and we should relate to it as if it is alive. Dark energy, you know, I'm looking at in a somewhat different way, and I think what has been interpreted as dark energy is actually waves emanating from what I talk about as the tree of life. And that may sound, again, you know, obviously it is something that goes back to ancient peoples and indigenous peoples, but I think it really now has been proven also by modern science that there is such a thing that you know, I may say it's the tree of life. Very few astronomers would say so, or probably none, maybe. But what's been found and what has been called the axis of evil by modern scientists, in fact, has many of the properties that the ancient peoples would give to the tree of life. And that is not a dead thing. It is a creative entity. And it creates on a very large scale. And I think it's based on that kind of creation that we can understand also what the dark energy is. There, in my interpretation, there isn't any dark energy. It's just that you get abnormalities when you study the movement of galaxies from each other, so, and these abnormalities can actually be explained if you take into account the sine wave movements of emanating from the Tree of Life.
I'm familiar with the Tree of Life in the Kabbalistic tradition, and your description of various levels. Monads is a name that comes into mind too, but also just the layeredness of light. The Ein Sof has the endless light has layers to it, as do the ten Sephirot have different consciousness that go down to Earth and Malkuth, and it begins to an ancient. Kabbalists thought they had a map of the universe when they were looking at the Eitz Chaim, the Tree of Life. And that's very similar to what you're describing now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Yeah.
We have to end in a bit, but when you talk about living and the dog running around you can't predict, there is a decision-making element in the behaviors you may be describing. It's as if I can decide to go here versus there. I go with the dog as a beautiful metaphor, perhaps. So when a galaxy is living and moves around, there's some kind of decision-making process going on. Could you describe how that might work?
Well, it's a little bit beyond me because we are small, or at least I am, compared to the galaxies. So it's a little bit, I don't know, how could I possibly understand that? But, you know, again, I think there are choices being made on these high levels of the universe. But it's on a completely different level than for us human beings.
I do very much understand that. And we've come to the end of this. And for today, it's been a real pleasure hearing you and understanding you better than I could looking at your book. I read some of it. Now I understand you much better, and I can understand what's in your book much better. The whole thing for me with meaningful coincidences is like so many other people, and that includes you, I'm thinking, I'm trying to use meaningful coincidence, synchronicity, serendipity to understand the mind of God.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure for me too.
Thank you. I'm glad it was. I'm glad it was a pleasure. Good. Yeah. Good. Because it's been a delight.
And maybe our personal synchronicities up in Washington State has something to do with it. Right?
They may. And certainly I knew Est when it was beginning. I wasn't part of it. I knew people who were in it. Yeah. So we have a few parallels. But like me, you probably love the Pacific Northwest. It's just a beautiful part of the world, and it's a wonderful thing to feel with you. I'm just thinking the Ravens who showed up.
Yeah,
is very much a much smaller metaphor for decision making at a higher level for me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That okay. Somehow. Okay.
Thank you. I mean, thank you welcome. For that interpretation. Yeah.
Thank you. And thank you for your wonderful conversation today, Carl, the calendar man. Thank you for being with me, and I very much appreciate your heartfelt sincerity in trying to figure out what's going on out there. So thank you very, very much.
This psychosphere is our mental atmosphere, like a hologram of cosmic consciousness.